Hundreds of thousands of people in Texas and Louisiana without power as Hurricane Laura makes landfall overnight. The View at First Light coming up today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Despite warnings of an unsurvivable storm surge and record-setting sustained winds, many along the northern Gulf Coast of Texas breathing a sigh of relief despite power outages and reports of property damage. Our conversations with people managing emergency efforts in Orange and Jefferson counties. Also, what's next in the aftermath of the storm, plus the rest of what's making news in the Lone Star State as the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. Along the northern Gulf Coast of Texas, as the most powerful storm ever recorded in the region made landfall sometime around 1 a.m. Thursday morning, the winds picked up dramatically. Road signs and traffic lights began to shudder. The rain went sideways, turning the skies into a cloud of water. Lights went out, and much of social media went silent. I'm David Brown, and this is the Texas Standard for Thursday, August 27th, 2020. Like many in southeast Texas, in the area often called the Golden Triangle, not far from the Louisiana border, Gary Sorage expected the worst.
It's just devastating. I mean, this is going to look like somebody just took a bunch of toothpicks and threw them on the ground.
Sorage owns and operates the Gator Country Adventure Park, an animal sanctuary and zoo in southwest Beaumont. He's been through 8 major storms in the 15 years he's owned the park, and Hurricane Laura looked like it could be the worst of all. There were predictions of winds reaching 150 miles per hour and a storm surge that the National Hurricane Center described as unsurvivable. Despite evacuation orders across the region, Sorage and his wife decided to pass the night in the park's main visitors building, hunkered down with snakes and lizards in glass tanks, waiting for the wind to stop.
When the sun comes up in the morning, I probably won't have a house here. My house is on the same property. I probably won't have a house here. I probably won't have a business here. And so my wife and I are trying to put that in our brain.
The storm made landfall shortly after midnight. By the first light of day, Sorage couldn't believe his eyes.
Man, I got to tell you, normally I'm used to waking up after these hurricanes and, walking through 4 or 5 foot of water, but I just can't believe it. I mean, we are totally unimpacted.
Hurricane Laura made landfall almost 100 miles to the east of Beaumont, ripping windows out of high-rises in Lake Charles, toppling TV towers and shearing sheet metal off of buildings. But on this side of the Sabine, many Texans heaved a sigh of relief and shared concerns about their Louisiana neighbors. There, at least one death was reported early Thursday, and there was considerable property damage. Jefferson County, Texas, includes Beaumont and Port Arthur. Both cities had been bracing for the worst. Joining us now is Jefferson County Judge Jeff Brannick, who rode the storm out at the county courthouse. Judge Brannick, welcome to the Texas Standard.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, there were a lot of very dire warnings. What was happening overnight where you were, which was at the courthouse Emergency Operations Center?
Well, we had known that this storm's destructiveness was going to be dependent on whether it took a jog to the left or a jog to the right. And fortunately for Texas and unfortunately for Louisiana, it took a slight jog to the right. Had the track that was forecast 2 days ago been correct, then our county would be covered in storm surge, and we would have much more wind damage to homes. Our winds got to be 89 miles per hour in the lower southern sections of the county. In the low 60s up in Beaumont, where the courthouse is located. I mean, there were times when it sounded like a freight train was coming around the building, but the rain impacts were not significant, and a couple of miles, 15, 20 miles to our east, the winds were 141 miles per hour. So,
wow.
We feel like we really dodged the bullet. I mean, we've got about 75,000 people in the county that are without power right now, or 75,000 households. But it's really turned into an event. The reports I'm getting back from my road and bridge commissioners are that transportation corridors are not adversely impacted. We have very few downed trees, very few downed power lines, and I credit it to some of the rebuilding efforts that took place in the aftermath of Hurricane Rita in 2005 and Ike in 2008 that, brought homes up to Texas wind storm standards and made them able to withstand these sub-100-mile storms.
Overnight, were you receiving a lot of calls there at the Emergency Operations Center or no?
No, which is... It is really strange because during Hurricane Harvey in 2017, we received thousands of calls and it was all hands on deck. The phone systems became overwhelmed because the city's EOC's phone started rolling over to the county EOC phones. And so compared to Harvey and Imelda, last night was a cakewalk.
This is so starkly different, in fact. Something I'm curious about, there were those mandatory evacuation orders that began fairly early. In fact, it's my understanding that a couple of C-130s landed near Port Arthur to ferry out last-minute evacuees. How did evacuations go? And we're talking about in the middle of a pandemic, too.
Yeah, the evacuations went very well. A couple of thousand people evacuated by buses, and most people, of course, self-evacuated. I'd say probably about 60% of the citizens evacuated, and about 40% chose to ride it out here, and that's turned out to be a good decision for them. Although it was illegal, it's not something that we can go out and arrest people for, and not something we're going to ticket them for, because we're utilizing our resources in other places. But I'm just really thrilled this morning, despite the fact that we do have widespread power outages. It's not the carnage that I've seen in my 13 years previously here.
What's next on your to-do list? I guess you got to clear off those roadways. Are people allowed to return to their homes? What's the situation there?
Yes, this morning I rescinded my order effective at 10 o'clock this morning, my mandatory evacuation order. People will be allowed to return and assess their homes. Some of them will come back, assess, and probably leave again to go stay somewhere where there is power. My power's out at my home, and I will probably just continue to bunk at the courthouse until they can get that restored.
Will there be a way for people to apply for some kind of relief, or where does that stand at this juncture? Any do you know yet?
Well, if the president approves a disaster declaration, then we would sometimes be eligible, but in order to get any kind of disaster relief, we would have to meet the state threshold. And Texas state threshold is about $40 million, and that's in public losses. So we're not going to have that for this event, and so we're not going to be eligible for any assistance. There might be some enhanced supplemental nutrition assistance program grant funding for the economically disadvantaged, but I don't see any SBA assistance or individual assistance, FEMA individual assistance, or any FEMA public assistance for public entities.
Jefferson County Judge Jeff Brannick has been up all night. He's been over at the courthouse where the Emergency Operations Center is located for Jefferson County. That encompasses Beaumont and Port Arthur, two southeast Texas cities along the Texas Gulf Coast that appear to have, for the most part, dodged quite a bullet. Judge Brannick, thank you again.
My pleasure. Take care now.
You too. Wells Dunbar monitoring social media. Wells, before we get to that, something I should update here. Within the past hour, we've heard from Louisiana's Governor John Bel Edwards, who says he's received the first report of a fatality on that side of the border from Hurricane Laura. A 14-year-old girl apparently crushed to death when a tree fell on her home. And now, I know that as they clear the roadways, I believe what we were hearing was at least in Jefferson County, about 40% of the people actually chose to stay and try to ride the storm out. And so we may see that number increase as the day goes along, but that's the latest as we have it. What are you hearing on social media?
Well, obviously, lots of concern out there about the storm, including those comments we're seeing from our friends and listeners, like Wayne Tubbs, who reached out to us via Facebook. He notes that while Hurricane Laura missed Houston, he's concerned about all those smaller counties that were in the path of the storm and if there will be volunteers to restore those areas. Lots of news coming in from reporters via Twitter, obviously. Elizabeth Findell with the Wall Street Journal, she tweeted a photo less than an hour ago of in Lake Charles of a what she described as a big fire at a plant or refinery, one that's getting bigger there south of I-10 at the Westlake exit, she says. Also seeing some remarkable photos from Jesus Jimenez with the Dallas Morning News, I believe, who had some photos of the damage from Lake Charles, those windows blown out of high rises, power lines down, and businesses destroyed. As we were learning, the Beaumont has luckily... was luckily sort of bypassed by the worst of what we saw. A rather remarkable tweet from Beaumont Enterprise reporter Kim Brent. She shared this photo of this, basically of this folded up vest like someone would wear, sitting on a part of a stairwell outside. And she notes that this vest was sitting in the same spot last night before we got locked down as the wind increased. It's still here. So a major bullet dodged that she describes there. And, you know, David, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to note that, you know, we heard about those people that elected to ride it out. They're also not mandatory, but recommended evacuation areas. Somewhat of a more lighthearted tweet from Elizabeth Troval at Houston Public Media. She knows that she spoke with a resident whose family is cooking up cornbread and pinto beans ahead of Hurricane Laura, which is barreling straight towards them, making the most of a bad situation. And she asked if anyone else was cooking or anxiously eating their hurricane snacks tonight. And lots of responses, like this one from Lupe Mendez. He says that he was making a whole pot of caldo de pollo just for the storm. Not a bad idea if you're going to be stuck at home and you need some food to ride things out, obviously.
I guess so. Yeah. You know, hat tip to the many journalists who've been covering this. I know that a lot of people were streaming Channel 12 out of Beaumont, which was providing continuous live coverage as the storm was approaching and as it hit. It was just remarkable, a remarkable job. Houston Chronicle has some terrific coverage as well, including a comprehensive flooding map we would encourage you to check out over at HoustonChronicle.com. Hurricane Laura ended up not being that much of a worry for Galveston or Houston, for that matter. Orange County, however, is another matter, and it was closest to the Louisiana border, most affected. We're going to be checking in with the judge in Orange County in just a moment as the Texas Standard continues. It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. A few minutes ago, we were checking in with a person directing emergency services in Jefferson County, where Beaumont and Port Arthur are located. Closer to the Louisiana border, where Hurricane Laura made landfall, the winds were more severe. John Gauthier is the judge in Orange County directing emergency services there. Judge Gauthier, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you, sir, for having me.
As I understand it, you were trying to ride this out in a building that was built to survive a Category 5 storm. Is that right?
Yes, sir. This building was built after Hurricane Rita and Hurricane Ike. We figured out we needed a facility that we could use and be able to house all our responders and keep them safe.
What was the situation like last night as that wind was howling?
Well, it was... you know, interior of the building, you'd have a hard time to even know what was going on, to be honest with you. This thing is like I said, it's built extremely well. But, you know, we would walk out. We have several doors we could walk out and look at, and they're hurricane-proof doors. So we were able to kind of see what was going on out there to get a better picture of it. But, you know, last night was wait and see as it came through, and you know, kind of seeing what we were going to need to, you know, preparing for what we were going to need to do as daylight hit this morning. And of course, we got you know, blessed with the fact that it did not hit us directly. It moved east of us as it was offshore, and that was a huge benefit to us. I mean, we hate it for our local neighbors because we know they took the brunt of it.
Still, you were dealing with some gusts that were in the triple digits, as I understand it. Were you getting 911 calls throughout the night or no?
I think the majority of our citizens, you know, heeded the warning and evacuated. And so, you know, that in itself was allowed us to be to not get a lot of calls on it. And also, when it did move east of us, the biggest benefit for us was, you know, was the fact that it removed us out of the storm surge area. And you know, and that's typically when we get a lot of our phone calls, is when those houses start flooding. And but we got very few calls last night, and are receiving very few calls today because people are still not in yet. We do have all of our teams out there assessing damage right now.
And what are you hearing from those teams? And what about when people can return to their homes? Is there evacuation orders still in effect, or where does that stand?
Right now, it's our evacuation order is still in place, but we are allowing people to come back into town already. You know, I'll probably lift that this afternoon. You know, we know people want to get home. You know, we've learned from storms in the past that people want to get back to their house. The only thing that we're asking them is that when they do return home is to try to be as safe as possible. You know, we're focusing right now on clearing the roadways is our first focus. And that way, when these people start moving into town, we know that they can move about in a safe way and not be injured by down power lines and trees and stuff. So that's what we're focusing on first.
We're seeing a lot of pictures from that area which do show down powered lines and trees and that kind of thing. Does that appear to be the greatest extent of the damage from what you can tell, or no?
Yeah, right now that's the majority we see. And we know there's a lot of home damage out there, you know, but it's minor. I mean, I say minor, but it's you know, not devastating type home damage that we've seen yet, you know. And of course, we still got a lot of homes to go, you know, but and as residents start coming in, we'll get more information on that. But what we're seeing from the major roadways right now is, you know, trees down, power lines down. You know, some of them are on houses. Some of them see a lot of roof damage, blown in garage doors. We see a lot of that, including in our own county buildings. You know, we've seen a lot of that. Glass broke, things like that.
Even though you weren't in the direct line of the eye of the storm, still, this was a serious weather event by any measure. And I'm curious, I think a lot of people are curious, on the morning after, what went right? What lessons can be learned from this experience? Have you been able to give much thought to that?
Every event that you have like this, you learn, you know, you know, we've learned from the ones in the past and how to be prepared. And you know, we have an excellent team here, and that knows how to. It's been through these before, and they do a really good job of putting stuff together so that we can react to whatever we need to, whether it's a flood event or whether it's a wind event. And that just comes from the ones we've had in the past, and we were prepared for that. But what we're seeing is those. You know, like I said, we were very fortunate in the fact that, you know, 15 miles east made a huge difference for us.
Well, that's right. But you got a lot of families and a lot of friends who crossed that borderline, you know. Any thought about what happens next, if there's going to be an effort to try to help your neighbors across into Louisiana, or too early yet?
You know, what we're trying to do is get our damage assessments done as quickly as we can. And so that once we get those assets and able to release them, our intent is to release them as soon as possible so that we can, you know, send them Louisiana's way so that we can go help our neighbors. You know, they came to our aid when we needed them, and so we want to be able to return that favor. And as soon as we get our guys clear from what we need them to do here, then we're going to push them that away, and we're going to push our resources that we have available to us to Louisiana to help them out.
Judge John Gauthier is judge of Orange County, and he's been managing the emergency response there along the border with Louisiana. Judge Gauthier, thanks so much, and do stay safe.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. We'll have more on Hurricane Laura and its aftermath as the show continues. For now, we're going to turn to the pandemic. Texas has one of the highest uninsured rates in the nation, and many of those individuals have been met with several challenges trying to get tested for COVID-19. Houston Public Media's Sarah Weller Ernst explores how the state and local governments have struggled to close the gaps.
Since the pandemic started in March, it was clear to government and public health officials that they'd have to do more to make sure people without health insurance could get tested for COVID-19. So, when Congress approved the Family First Coronavirus Response Act, they included funding to improve access to testing. It narrowly expanded Medicaid funding to fully cover the cost of testing for anybody without health insurance. And Texas opted into this in mid-April. But 4 months later,
our state has never gotten that up and running.
That's Ann Dunkelberg. She directs the healthcare policy team at the think tank Every Texan in Austin. She's been asking state health authorities about it.
Part of the last response I got from our Texas Health and Human Service Agency, one of the reasons that they had not moved forward was because they didn't know how long it would last.
The funding is available as long as the U.S. is under a public health emergency, a status that was renewed until the end of October. Dunkelberg says this is how the state explained the delay to her.
They didn't want to go to the trouble to do the computer work and costs and systems that would have to be set up to have that benefit if it was only going to be for like 2 months.
Houston Public Media followed up with the Texas Health and Human Services Commission and asked about the status of expanding this COVID-19 testing. A spokesperson wrote in an email that the agency is still working to implement the program. Ann Dunkelberg says Texas should want to use this funding because there's no limit on how much states can tap into it.
It's not like just a fixed pot of money and when you run out, it's all done.
Other funding streams for COVID-19 testing are capped at a certain amount. It's been a challenge to get fast, accurate testing to people this summer, as Texas has struggled to contain the coronavirus outbreak. Earlier, free public testing in Houston was marked by long lines and slow results. There were days when sites closed by noon because of the heat, or because they had reached their daily testing capacity. In early August, the city of Houston and Harris County opened 4 new surge testing sites, funded by the federal government. For the city, that more than doubled their overall testing capacity. And these tests promise much faster results, anywhere from 2 to 4 days, according to Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo.
These have been rushed to our area because of the need and because of the recognition that these federal tests were seeing incredibly slow turnaround times, sometimes up to 14 days.
Demand for these tests has gone down in recent weeks, which is likely to translate to shorter lines. But access to testing can only help control the spread of the coronavirus if the public uses the service. I'm Sarah Willa Ernst in Houston.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Cities and counties throughout southeast Texas ordered evacuations due to Hurricane Laura, but some residents hunkered down at home. Houston Public Media's Kyra Buckley shares the experience of one Texan who chose to stay put.
While thousands of people evacuated along the coastline, Chris Johnson rode out the storm at his home in Port Neches. Around 1 this morning, he posted on Facebook a video of intense rain and wind pummeling his yard.
This is definitely some of the worst I've seen. Wow.
Johnson said he heard cracking around him, like the sound of trees about to fall. He said they had already lost power in the area. I'm Kyra Buckley in Houston.
The U.S. Army is investigating the death of Fort Hood soldier Elder Fernandez. Local police found his body Tuesday night about 30 miles from the Killeen military base. That's about a week after he went missing. Before his death, Sergeant Fernandez reported he'd been sexually abused by a superior. Justin Redfern is the commander of the 23-year-old battalion.
At this time, I don't see any connection. But this is something that ongoing investigation will determine, I think, as we move forward, but I do not perceive a connection.
Army investigators say an autopsy is being conducted today. Fernandez is the third soldier to go missing from Fort Hood in the past year. The third night of the Republican National Convention featured Houston GOP Congressman Dan Crenshaw, who argued America's future depends on reelecting President Trump, though he did not mention him by name.
But if we are to rediscover our strength, then it must be an endeavor undertaken by each and every one of us. We must become the heroes that we so admire. America was built by them, and our future will be protected by them. It will be protected by you.
The former Navy SEAL also praised members of the U.S. military, law enforcement, and the healthcare system. Former Houston Rockets guard Kenny Smith is showing his support for NBA players protesting the police shooting of Jacob Blake, a 29-year-old black man. Smith, who's an analyst with TNT's Inside the NBA, walked off set yesterday after the Milwaukee Bucks boycotted Game 5 of their series against the Orlando Magic.
As a black man, as a former player, I think it's best for me to support the players and just not be here tonight.
No NBA games were held yesterday. WNBA, MLB, and MLS teams also refused to play in protest. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the online UT High School, offering a full-time diploma program and a variety of individual courses, including for advanced placement. Learn more about options for the new school year at highschool.utexas.edu.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard time. I'm David Brown. School's back in session for most Texas students. Some are trying in-person classes with strict safety guidelines in place. Others are sticking to virtual learning. Both options are not without the challenges. Our tech expert Omar Gayaga says virtual or distance learning has changed a bit since the spring. He knows both as a journalist for Tech Minute Texas and as a parent. Omar, welcome back to the Standard.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a lot to juggle, isn't it? I mean, you got to, especially if you're trying to work from home.
If parents, you know, seem a little bit more frazzled this last 2 weeks, it's because we're all kind of freaking out. But yeah, we're trying to hang in there.
So far, so good. Be honest, how has back to school been for your family?
It's been a bit of a struggle. We just started this week. I know some schools in a couple of other cities are delayed a bit, but we started up this week and, you know, right from the jump, you know, Zoom outage Monday, Canvas issues Tuesday, right. You know, like right. I've had some crying kids and some, having to do daddy tech support a couple of times already.
Yeah, it's interesting to see, especially how younger kids are responding to this, because they want to make a good impression on that first few days. And, you know, if Zoom isn't working, it can cause a lot of anxiety, not just for kids, but for parents, too. Any explanation about what actually happened with Zoom earlier this week? Because it made a lot of headlines.
And I mean, it affected not just schools, but I mean, you know, all the businesses that rely on Zoom, you know, college campuses. I believe it was just a server overload. I mean, we have so many people using Zoom all of a sudden that I think the system was just overwhelmed. I don't know that I've seen any official word on what actually caused it, but that was sort of the impression, was that it was just a lot of people getting on at the same time, which doesn't bode well if, you know, in 2-3 weeks, you know, when we see another, you know, big round of people getting on Zoom again for the first time, you know, since spring, we might see some more of these outages happening again.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about that, but especially if you're not exactly sure how to prevent something like this. What about the technology to even get folks on Zoom? Some school districts are able to provide limited tech, but in other situations, a lot of the burden here is falling squarely on the shoulders of parents.
Yeah, that's been an ongoing conversation since spring, since we kind of got into this mess, was the equity issue, is that, you know, families that don't have broadband or don't have good broadband, families that don't have the devices to be able to take advantage of some of these technologies, you know, what are they doing? So in a lot of school districts, you know, that issue iPads, like my kids, you know, they pick up their device, they bring it home and they use it. But, you know, is the internet stable enough for them to use it? Are they skilled enough to use the device? We are seeing things like laptop shortages. That there are some school districts that are dealing with that, with some of the major tech companies saying, you know, we just do not have enough laptops to sell right now. I think there's like a 5 million unit shortage on laptops right now for school districts mm-hmm. that use mm-hmm. them. Some of it is pandemic related in the sense that manufacturing in China has slowed down quite a lot. So there's a shortage from that end as well. So it's a lot for parents and school districts to deal with, even just on the hardware and internet side.
Something that I noticed in the first couple of days of classes, at least for one of my kids, it seemed as if the school had gone out of its way not to put a great emphasis on the education part, but more just on getting the connections right, you know, trying to work out the kinks. And it struck me as such a major contrast with last spring. It's as if last spring everyone was trying to get back to normal or get back to, you know, the books and to homework as quickly as possible. And you were sort of trying to, it was kind of like trying to repair the wings of an airplane while you were in flight. You know what I mean? Do you notice that that schools are taking a different approach this go around?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in the spring, it was like, let's just get it working as quickly as we can and cobble this together. And I think that's an apt description, is just trying to like pull it together as quickly as possible to get it and to normalize things as quickly as possible. I think as we go into this fall semester, I think schools are being a little bit more methodical, a little bit more thoughtful about how they're approaching this stuff. And, you know, the big challenge for them, for the ones that are doing in-person and remote, is trying to make an equitable approach to both, to having the remote students have the same exact educational experience as in-person, which is kind of impossible, but at least on the learning side, they want to try to make it equitable. So that's a huge challenge. In our school district, we're seeing teachers that are having to bring in students from multiple schools, not just their own school. We're seeing teachers who are having to juggle, you know, like 30 or 40 students remote and, you know, 15 to 20 in person. So it's a big load for teachers. But I think definitely they're trying to ease students back into the tech, ease parents back into the tech, and not have them feel so overwhelmed, because that was a huge issue in the spring, was we don't know how to do this. We don't know how to adjust to this so quickly. I think the first week or two in a lot of schools is going to be like, let's just ease into this. Let's get everybody comfortable with the technology side before we start, you know, sending out lots of assignments.
Omar Gayaga is Texas Standard's go-to tech expert, and he's the guy behind TechMinuteTexas.com. Omar, thanks so much, and good luck.
Thank you, David. We're going to need it. I appreciate it.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
This is the Texas Standard. My name is Marcia Wilson Rappaport. I'm a published author, a history as a journalist, and a freelance writer. I live in Galveston. I started wearing a mask early. I started wearing a mask in March because the first conversation about COVID was about being over 65. And I'm over 65, I'm 69, and all I could think is, at my age, catching COVID would not be a good thing. Actually, just by odd chance, I had some face masks in the house because I was painting some stuff. So I had a stash of industrial masks. I have a PPE to-go bag that I literally keep on a chair. And I have a staging area where I have clean masks, and a bin for dirty mask, and I have hand sanitizer. Well, I'm going to be very honest with you. I started my column, which was about being a senior citizen and all the things that make us crazy. I started a blog in the fall, and COVID showed up, and my brain went into total brain freeze. You know, it's like, what can I possibly say in a situation like this? So it occurred to me, one of the things that really has been affected, because I'm in a tourist destination, our restaurants have really, really been badly impacted by COVID. And the other thing is, being a senior citizen, being locked in the house and being kind of stalked by a deadly disease is real depressing. So what I decided was, why don't I just give a meal to somebody else who might be very depressed about this situation and like me, on a limited budget, really can't afford a really good restaurant meal. So that was what I decided to do and write about it. And I just want to kind of keep it going through the community. The idea is just to let people know, listen, if you can keep it rolling over 65, you can keep it rolling when you're 30, even in a pandemic. It's about giving people hope and a sense of purpose, if that makes any sense at all. My name is Marcia Wilson Rappaport, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
We're collecting stories about this unique moment in Texas history when Texans are required to wear masks. You can share your story with us on social media or email texasstandard@kut.org. The Republican National Convention is set to conclude tonight, and lots of people are focused on the presidential race nationwide. And in Texas, there's another high-profile election on the ballot, the race for one of two Senate seats. This fall, incumbent Senator John Cornyn faces a challenge by Democratic nominee M.J. Hagar, an Air Force veteran. KERA's Brett Jaspers takes a look at Cornyn's 18 years in office.
In late 2018, after a divisive midterm election, Republicans and Democrats in the Senate passed a rare bipartisan bill. In broad terms, it eased mandatory minimum sentences for some federal crimes, including nonviolent drug charges. It also reformed prison practices to improve rehabilitation.
And these were seen as general best practices in the field.
Derek Cohen worked on the bill as a policy director for criminal justice reform at the conservative think tank Texas Public Policy Foundation.
And for that reason, they were generally less controversial, both within the GOP and, you know, I'd say in within population generally.
Texas Senator John Cornyn, a Republican, pushed for the prison reform parts of the law. It was something Cornyn worked on in some form since 2013, Cohen said.
He has a very pronounced focus on making sure that the final product is right, that it's correct, that it's not building the plane as it flies, as it were.
There was some last-minute drama, but President Trump signed the First Step Act that December. It was an example of the deal-making Sean Theriault says Cornyn is known for.
So in today's Senate, where we have a whole lot of people that like to use really strong rhetoric and burn down the House, like I think of John Cornyn as one of these people who does care about solving problems.
Theriault is a professor at the University of Texas at Austin and an expert on Congress. On at least two other major issues, however, Cornyn has critics who don't see him as a problem solver at all. One is judicial nominations. Cornyn and his fellow Texas Senator Ted Cruz have worked quickly in the Trump era to fill federal judgeships in Texas. Here's Cornyn at a press conference in 2017.
But we know that this is one of the main reasons why President Trump was elected over Hillary Clinton in the first place, because of the importance of these nominees and the service of these judges from the Supreme Court down to the Court of Appeals, down to the district court.
But Christopher Kang says many of those vacancies existed because Cornyn and Cruz wouldn't compromise on nominees with former President Barack Obama. Kang worked in the Obama White House and is now chief counsel at the group Demand Justice.
I think that Senator Cornyn was more than happy to try to run out the clock and to see what would happen in the election. And then, as we saw when President Trump won, he rushed very quickly to fill all of those vacancies that he had helped keep open for years.
Cornyn has long influenced which judges sit on the federal bench in Texas, as senators traditionally have input over appointments in their states. Cornyn worked with the Bush administration to appoint Reed O'Connor, the judge who threw out the entire Affordable Care Act in 2018. Again, Christopher Kang.
The reason we're here is because Senator Cornyn's former staffer, Reed O'Connor, set us on the trajectory. And I think that it's important to recognize how much influence he has had on our courts, not only in Texas, but the impact now nationwide.
The Affordable Care Act case is on the Supreme Court's docket this fall. Yet another area where Cornyn has influence in the Senate and a long record is immigration. He holds sway as a conservative Republican from a border state and sits on the Subcommittee on Border Security and Immigration. Bipartisan, comprehensive immigration reform has had a few high-profile near misses in the past 15 years. Here's Cornyn after a 2007 effort.
We need to go back and listen to our constituents. We need to talk to them and explain to them what the problem is. We need to have a transparent process that's an interactive process where we can listen to them and we can tell them what we've learned about this issue and about some of the problems and try to come up with a solution.
But Cornyn's talk of finding solutions sounds disingenuous to Frank Sherry. Sherry runs the nonprofit America's Voice and has spent decades working on immigration reform. He points out Cornyn consistently votes against major bipartisan deals, even those taking a conservative approach. Sherry says Cornyn is known for undermining immigration deal-making whenever lawmakers get close.
Well, there's always a deal space or a sweet spot. He would make sure he was outside of that space. Pretend like he wanted it, go back to Texas and make beautiful speeches about how he was fighting for immigration reform, while in Washington, he was making sure to pull the rug out from those who were actually serious about getting it done.
The Cornyn campaign told KERA he wasn't available for an interview for this story. Sean Theriault at UT Austin considers Cornyn to be influential on immigration reform, part of a second rung of senators who worked on a bill in 2013.
People say that he dropped out of the conversations. He would say that he is pushed out of the conversations.
Aside from his policy decisions, Cornyn has used his 18 years in the Senate to ascend to the number two position among Republicans, a post that ended after the last election. He was also chair of the National Republican Senatorial Committee, or NRSC, for two campaign cycles. His job was to raise money and help his party win. Carlos Algarra at the University of Texas at El Paso said it endeared him to his fellow caucus members.
It really helps you with your colleagues, especially colleagues, you know, that really rely heavily on the NRSC to win open seats and to unseat incumbents.
Now that same NRSC is helping John Cornyn in his contest for a fourth Senate term. I'm Brett Jaspers in Dallas.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. We're going to loop back to our top story of the day, and that is, of course, the aftermath of this unprecedented storm, at least unprecedented in strength. Hurricane Laura continues its north-northeast trajectory, bringing a whole lot more rain and wind to parts of North Texas, Louisiana, and Arkansas today. But back closer along the Texas Gulf Coast, rescue crews are still trying to assess the damage, and they're not seeing a whole lot from what we're hearing from Sig Christensen. He covers the military for the San Antonio Express News. He's in Beaumont, has been with rescue workers and members of the Texas Guard for the past many hours. Sig, you are at a kind of a staging facility there along I-10, as I understand it, right?
Yes, this is the Ford Arena. It's right off the interstate. What we have here is a fairly large group of first responders and folks from the Texas Task Force 1, which is from Texas A&M, and the 386th Forward Support Company. Now, that's with the Texas Guard. So far, they've had people out scouting, seeing who might need help. We have not received orders yet, so we're waiting. They have a game plan, and they're ready to execute it. It's a question, though, as to whether they'll have to, because the damage here doesn't seem to be severe. And from what I've been told, there was no flooding.
Which is pretty remarkable, especially when you consider some other recent storms and the fact that meteorologists and forecasters were saying that this could be another Hurricane Ike. You had a lot of high winds last night. What was the scene like there in that building? I imagine you must have heard it howling.
It was loud. We were sleeping on the second floor or the third floor of this building. I shot some video of the storm outside. My guess is that the winds were about 60 or 70 miles an hour at that point. They got up to over 100, that's what they tell me. But the noise was tremendous, and while people looked like they were sleeping, I'm betting almost nobody did. Hmm. And I think I only got maybe 4, maybe 5 hours of sleep. And so everybody here is a bit tired, and yet, you know, they're pushing on because there's a job to do, hopefully not a big one. If you go east of here by about an hour,
right.
That's another story.
I'm not hearing any reports of a loss of life, which is remarkable considering the wind speeds, certainly in Louisiana, where they were in the triple digits and fairly sustained, too. Are you hearing any reports of loss of life?
None.
It's
absolutely
remarkable.
None.
What do you think? What can we attribute this to? Better preparation? People taking steps to try to get out of harm's way early, reinforcing their homes, that sort of thing? What do you think is the explanation here?
Well, we've had a lot of storms over the years, and they seem to be getting worse and worse. When you have that kind of experience, people tend to respect the weather, and they don't underestimate it. People are veterans of these storms, and they're not taking chances. They're not doing stupid things. That's probably the reason why people are surviving. The damage, and if you look at these storms overall through the last 120 years, go back mm-hmm. to the Galveston storm, which nobody saw coming, anything between 6,000 to 12,000 dead. in that storm. Damages are always the big part of storms in the modern era, and deaths seem to be much lower than they used to be. So I guess that's good. But when you've had as much experience with these storms as people have in Houston and all the way over Louisiana from Ike and Katrina and Rita, just to name three storms, they're ready for them.
We've been speaking with Sig Christensen, who is embedded with Texas Guard at a staging area, which is just west of Beaumont. He is with the San Antonio Express News, and we'll have links over at texasstandard.org to more of Sig's content. Sig, thanks again, and stay safe.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is our social media editor. Wells, before we get to some of the comments that I know you've been tracking, we should point out that we spoke with Sig a little bit before we went live with the broadcast, and at that time there were no reports of deaths, but Louisiana's governor has confirmed, in fact, one death in Louisiana, at least one death in Louisiana, a 14-year-old girl who apparently was crushed by a tree. And as people make their way back to their homes and assess damage, and we don't know how many people actually chose to ride out the storm, right, and a lot of the roadways have been blocked by downed trees and power lines. So the numbers could be increasing as the day goes on, but I wanted to point that out since there was a reference in that conversation.
No, definitely. So important to know. And just, you know, obviously an ongoing situation we're continuing to monitor that people are paying very close attention to. I'm seeing a remarkable tweet from our friend Lucia Briones, who tweets us these images of the Katrina's landfall, Harvey's landfall, and Laura's landfall. And she notes that they all transpired in this final week of August. In her words, it's officially proven the high risk of intense hurricane landfalls along the Third Coast, all hitting here at in the waning days of summer, I guess you could call them. So obviously a story that we're going to be continuing to follow. Were it the only story, so much news, it seems like, breaking over the last day or so, honestly. Mm-hmm. One big story that people are talking about is how what's left of the NBA season could be in doubt after the Milwaukee Bucks elected not to play last night in protest of police violence in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and elsewhere. And as we heard a little bit about this in the news roundup earlier, setting off a chain reaction across major league sports. You could call them boycotts, you could call them wildcat strikes, but obviously remains to be seen whether or not this amounts to a sort of tipping point when it comes to labor, when it comes to sports, when it comes to the Black Lives Matter movement. So lots of interesting perspectives on this. Via our Facebook page, Jennifer Ramos says, "What's infuriating is that so many accept or even revere black people on a court or ball field while simultaneously failing to denounce the systemic racism that holds back generations of Americans." And she says this is an important message. Michael Muniz says that the season was lost anyway, but now that they've started these boycotts, how far will they take it? And will it help at all? And lastly, John Huddleston applauds it. He says it's good. Change doesn't come easily or cheap.
It'll be interesting to see what happens with the remainder of the season, of course. A lot of people wondering whether or not this might be the end of, at least for the season, of basketball. We'll just have to see how this all plays out. But it is unprecedented, most certainly. Yeah. And it speaks to the times we're in, no doubt.
Decidedly so. So we can expect the latest on that to percolate on social media. You know, right now I've got TweetDeck in front of me right now, and it seems that the ESPN is reporting that some NBA players may have decided to resume the playoffs. Obviously, a very contentious situation, lots of back and forth, lots of focus on LeBron James. You know, he's been very involved in the sort of social justice aspects of league play. So we're going to hear more about this along with Hurricane Laura. And gosh, last night the RNC. So much happening out there, David.
So much happening.
Crazy.
Yes. Hurricane Laura is not completely over. It's been downgraded considerably as it moves away from the Texas-Louisiana border. Still about 70,000 Texans reported to be out of power in the East Texas counties of Jefferson, Orange, and Hardin. So reports the Texas Tribune. We're out of time for the broadcast. The news continues over at texasstandard.org. We hope you'll join us again on Friday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.